Good evening. This is Stephen Otero speaking, and you're listening to Mondo Eros live on bbsradio.com. And we are back tonight with a brand new original broadcast, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. I think we're going to have some really interesting conversations because I have with me one of my favorite people that I like to talk to. He's been on the show before with his lovely wife, Patricia. But tonight I have Mark Michaels, who is the co-author of The Essence of Tantric Sexuality and also Tantric for Erotic Empowerment. And I strongly suggest everybody who's listening, who's trying to learn about Tantra, who wants to create a Tantric library, get these books. They are extremely well written. I believe Mark and Patricia are two of the finest Tantric teachers, if not in New York City, if not in the whole country. They are lineage-based. They are the real deal. They're the real thing. And I'm very happy to have Mark as my guest for tonight.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for that intro. That's kind of like mind-blowing, but thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Well, Tantra is kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think we're going to have a good... And I mean it. I mean that sincerely. I remember meeting the two of you way back in 2001, down at that place, oh, God, it was down by the World Trade Center.
Tears Place. What was that called? The Loft or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's the first time I met the two of you. And then about a few years later, you were up at Sexy Spirits for one of Nan Weiss's events. And I said, I know those two. I know where they are. I know. Yeah. And then we started talking and communicating again.
And, you know, we actually met at Sexy Spirits. The first class I taught, Patricia came to, and that's how we met. Going to be 11 years in January. So.
Wow. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And, you know, I really am a big supporter of these two books, especially Essence of Tantric Sexuality, just because there's just so much wonderful information in them. Particularly because of your association with Dr. John Munford and the fact that you had access to the Gnosticon lectures, which practically, I don't know if they exist anymore anywhere else.
Well, they're almost impossible to find, if not impossible to find. And they were released on cassette, and they went out of print probably in the early 80s. And... you know, people who had them borrowed from them a lot, and
yes.
Often without crediting John or Dr. Mumford Swamiji. And one of the reasons we wrote the first book was really to try and set the record straight, get him into his proper place in the history of Tantra, because he was probably the first traditionally trained and initiated Western Swami to come back from India and talk about sexual tantra in public.
Yes.
And the lectures really kind of, you know, it's sort of the same time as Osho or Rajneesh was really big. And of course, he didn't have really a traditional background, but sort of between those two, that gave birth to the tantric movement in America. And Dr. Mumford really doesn't get the credit that he deserves for that, you know, tremendous influence that he had.
Well, absolutely.
So we wanted to make sure that his contribution was recognized.
Yeah, it's an amazing work because I have read his other works, and I just think, you know, I'm really pleased that you did that, and that you are also, you and Patricia both are the carriers of the lineage here, are you not?
Yeah, we are.
So I'm glad that. I'm very glad for that. And I think that there should be, you know, there should be someone doing that. There should be someone who has, you know, who did the training, who went through the actual things, who are the actual initiates, and who have, you know, more than just a piece of paper that someone signed.
Yeah. I mean, you can pay, you know, $2,000 and take a training or whatever it is. I don't even really know anymore. But, you know, and then you're certified as a Tantra teacher, and that's, you know, that's great. It's not to denigrate people. People come out of those kind of things, and they can really help others with it, but it's not nearly as deep as going back to that source.
Right. Well, we're talking about true, in the case of Dr. Mumford, I would say we're talking about true Western mysticism here, even though he was trained in the East.
Yeah, and you know, his whole background is eclectic. I mean, he's a chiropractor, an osteopath. He's studied Crowley. He's studied a lot of the Western traditions, Rosicrucianism, the Masons, all of that. And he also has the Eastern background. So he's in a kind of unique position in which he can convey these very traditional Eastern approaches within the framework of Western thought as well. And that's a very special thing, too.
And he's had, I believe, several, there are several articles that he has up at Llewellyn at their website, which I found quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
And he also wrote, the one that I really liked was that he came out basically, he came out against this whole anti-ejaculation thing, which someone who we both know, Lawrence Lanoff, recently wrote a rant about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting and complicated subject, and it always gets people kind of worked up. There is in India and in the Ayurvedic tradition in particular an idea that's akin to what the Taoists talk about in terms of, you know, losing your vital energy through ejaculation. Of course, we know at this point physiologically that's kind of nonsense. And in fact, there's a lot of research that shows that frequent ejaculation is much healthier.
Yes.
For men. But in classical tantra, the culmination of the sexual ritual involved and really required ejaculation. And so to say, you know, this is a bad thing and we shouldn't do it is really not in keeping with what the tradition is about. Having said that, it can be a very useful learning tool if you work with non-ejaculatory sex for a period of time, learn how to move the energy out of the genital area and spread it through your whole body. It's an important part of the process, but people kind of attach to it as a dogma and as
yes,
you know, or they take the Taoist idea that, you know, you're at a certain age and you have this many left and that sort of thing. And, I mean, I'm 50 and I actually find that even at this age that the more often I ejaculate, within reason, of course. I mean, I'm not like I was when I was 18, but
right.
If I don't ejaculate, I reach a kind of level of diminishing returns where my whole energy starts to dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually find that kind of the more that I do, the more turned on I'm going to be. But you know, everybody's different physiologically, and,
right.
And I'm not going to like get on a soapbox and say you must do it the way that I do.
Oh, absolutely. But that strikes me because you know tantra is supposed to be anti-dogma, and yet I see that there's plenty of dogma.
Yeah.
I mean, what's that all about? I mean, is that just like people who still haven't gotten over Western Judeo-Christian traditions and they've simply just swapped one prison for another?
Well, you know, I don't think it's just in the West. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that there are people who come from more kind of orthodox Hindu traditions that look at tantra and sexual tantra and some of the ideas that, you know, that we've learned through our lineage as being off base and wrong too. You know, we don't have a monopoly on Puritanism in this part of the world. I mean, it's you know, if you go into, yeah, I mean, I think that religion as opposed to spirituality, in many instances really fosters that kind of Puritanism, because it's like you can control people with that.
Oh, yeah. So we're back to the whole right-hand path versus the left-hand path thing again.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me a little bit, for those who are not aware, that why we have a little laughter about the so-called dreaded left-hand path.
Well, yeah, the left-hand path got a really bad name in the West, beginning in the late 19th century with a theosophist who presented it as being black magic and evil and all of that sort of thing. And I think Aleister Crowley, of course, made quite a fortune, or made and spent quite a fortune on dope.
Spent is more likely.
with the whole left-hand path, you know, the associations that we have in the West with the left-hand path as being something evil. That's very, very deep in our culture. I mean, if you look at Romance languages, the word sinister and the word is the word for left.
Yes.
And in India, of course, there's stuff about the left hand as well, but that has more to do with hygiene than with good and evil. And I mean, to get very arcane about it, the Sanskrit word vama, which when you talk about Vama Marga, is the left-hand path of Tantra, it means left, and it does have some negative associations, but it also has similar, or it's connected to the word for beautiful and the word for the female breast. And so there's a much more complicated connection with the left hand in linguistically in Indian culture and in Tantra. So there isn't this sense that it's evil that we have in the West.
Seems to me, if you know, the more I research it, and the more I look at it, and I try to look at it from a dogma-free perspective, thanks to people like you and knowing people like Lawrence. It seems to me like it's just another control thing. You know, they figured out, hey, you know, don't let them know about this because, you know, then they'll be able to do something. So let's call it, oh, it's evil, it's sinister, you know, and then we don't want people to do sex magic. Oh, they might get out of their caste, out of their classes and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that one of the core things about the tantric tradition, and, you know, and it does get complicated because in irresponsible hands, it can be a risky approach.
Yes.
But it is about breaking free from that kind of social control and really finding your own truth. It's not about obedience and submission to some authority. You do have a relationship of reverence and honor for your guru, but the good teacher or the good guru isn't about, and this is something our teacher always says, it's not about creating followers, or disciples. It's about creating free people, teachers, gurus. You know, it's not the purpose of that relationship is not to make you subservient to somebody else. It's to guide you to your own freedom.
Right. So I don't think that just since you have a guru and you are also you have an initiate name, you are a swami.
Yes.
So that means that you are your own master.
Right. And that's the meaning of the word swami.
So I don't take it that you'll be going off to Sedona to some place and going into one of those tent things.
I have no plans to.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen now anyway, so I think you lost the opportunity.
And I sure won't be spending $9,000 to do it.
Yeah, to get a hot bath and maybe die. But there is a chance, possibly, that during that you just might reach enlightenment. But I don't think that's the way to go about it. We're gonna have some fun tonight, folks. So
I think people worry too much about enlightenment, too.
Yes.
just live your life. You know, don't. I mean, as long as you're seeking something, I think you're caught up in a kind of consumerist mindset. like, I've got to get this thing.
Yes.
And it's out there, and, you know, if I take this next workshop or I do this or I do that, then I'm going to get it. And it's not to say you shouldn't, it's valuable to pursue things and to seek knowledge and to learn and all of that. But if you're caught up on some big goal, like enlightenment especially,
yeah,
you're really not, you know, it's like, oh, am I there now?
Yeah.
No, I got to do this other thing, you know, and you just go on and on with that. And it's, what a way to live your life.
Yeah, I remember...
Not to live your life, exactly.
Yeah, not to live your life. Well, there was a recent interview that Lawrence Lanoff did. He said, one of the biggest regrets I have in my life is all the time I spent on my spiritual practices instead of living my life. And I said,
yeah,
when I needed you 20 years ago, you know?
Well, I think the thing about it is, and you know, this is more in the kind of highest Tibetan Buddhist teachings, but it's really about living your life and integrating the practice, or integrating the knowledge that you've gained through the practice, not the intellectual knowledge, but the spiritual knowledge, the unconscious knowledge, and finding a way to do that as much as you can all the time. It's not, I mean, I talk to people often and they're like, so what do you do? What are you know, what's your spiritual practice? And it's like they have this competition thing, like, well, I meditate for 4 hours a day, or I do this and I do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, great, you know, good for you.
Yeah.
That's nice, you know.
Well, that brings us more or less to the subject of tonight's broadcast. I'm calling it anyway, Punk Tantra, because I've sort of been bugging Mark about this for a while now.
Yeah.
I think in a nice way anyway. Just because you have something at your blog that you wrote, which is blog.tantrapm.com, and the regular website is tantrapm.com. It's a little something called Punk Tantra, but this is that you wrote on your own.
Yeah.
And by no means are we excluding Patricia. So, Patricia, if you're listening in, hi, Patricia. Tell me a little bit about this concept, because it's quite fascinating to me, and I think it would be a great book when and if you ever write it. I think it'll be a fantastic book, and you know, probably if you have any pictures, or probably just some of the pictures you can paint.
Yeah, I wrote the article or the blog entry about 2 years ago, and to be honest, I'm not like actively blogging these days. There's just too many other things going on. But I started thinking about my roots and looking at ways in which my life has connected and things that I did in my youth that resonate still. And I was very involved in the New York punk scene in the 70s. I was in a band when I was in college in Ann Arbor. And, I mean, I spent my junior and senior years in high school, like every weekend I was at CBGB's or Max's.
Right.
And it was really, like, from the time I was about 16 till 22 or so, that was the central thing in my life. And I started looking at how does that all connect up with who I am today. And as I thought about it, I was like, and you know, of course, the music shaped me, and you know, I still love it. I don't listen to it all the time, but it's still kind of, you know, that it's like in my blood in a very deep way. And so I started thinking about, well, how does this relate to where I am now? And I kind of discovered that the whole punk movement was really very deeply tantric, and in my opinion, more so than than a lot of the New Age Tantra that's out there. That's kind of, you know, let's dance in the light and be loving and play lame New Age music about the goddess. That, that's all fine in its place, but you know, Tantra is much bigger than that, and
yes.
And the ferocity of that scene, for one thing, the intensity of it, that kind of, you know, William Blake Rambo thing of the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, and that kind of mentality that was part of the scene, I think really connects much more deeply with what I think Tantra is about than some of the more fluffy stuff that's popular. Because, of course, Tantra is way, way, way more than just sex.
Yes.
It's about, as I see it, it's a way of living your life. It's about a stance in life. And I think the punk stance is awfully close to what the tantric stance is.
Well, that brings me to the, there's a Hindu word, a Hindu term, I think we've both talked about before.
Yeah.
So I have it right here. I'm just scrolling down.
Sachara, is it?
Yes, sir. It's basically, it's the Hindu version of do what thou wilt.
Right.
Svechichara. I don't know if I'm saying it right, sir. S-V-E-C-C-H-A-C-H-A-R-A.
I think it's Svechara.
Yeah.
Although I'm no Sanskrit scholar, so.
Yeah. But basically, and that's one of the highest principles, is to live your life. It's your life. You know, you are the master. Go out and do it. Don't seek somebody else.
Yeah.
You can certainly seek someone as a guide, but ultimately it's your choice.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, I think that, you know, what happened with punk, unfortunately, is that when the whole British punk movement got popular and got a lot of press, things became very regimented. And I mean, I can remember going in the 90s to see bands, younger bands, and there was kind of this dress code and everybody sort of,
right.
You know, it's like, okay, we're punks and this is what we do. And the early punk scene in New York was totally not like that. The diversity of it was pretty dramatic. You know, musically, I mean, you had bands from like the Talking Heads, and you had bands like the Ramones, and you had bands like Blondie, and they really sounded pretty different. But there was a sensibility there that was shared by everybody, and you had, you know, at CBGB's at that time, the club usually wouldn't sell out, and it wasn't a big popular scene quite yet. I'm talking early 1976. It was starting to get big, but it hadn't really crossed over.
Right.
And it was just the most kind of incredibly inclusive place that you could imagine. It's sort of, I see it as kind of the last gasp of a truly bohemian kind of mentality.
Yes.
Because you had, I mean, you had everything from, you know, hippie-looking people to Hell's Angels to, you know, prep school kids and the whole spectrum. And, of course, it was New York, you know. I was 16. Nobody cared about carding you, you know, and it also, I mean, in terms of sexual orientation, the scene was very, very open. You know, if you think Patti Smith's first album, she had a song on it about a female lover, Redondo Beach, and you know, that kind of stuff wasn't really done then.
Right.
So it was a place where every kind of misfit found a home.
Right.
And there wasn't any kind of regimentation about how you looked or how you acted or, you know, how you danced. Or, I mean, CBGBs then, you didn't dance. It was all sitting at tables. But it was just an incredible, you know, for a 16-year-old to go into that world. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was a legitimate bohemian continuation of that movement, of that kind of lifestyle, of that era. That was how it was in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. And you felt this, I mean, I can't say I felt it then, but if you look at it sort of in the historical view, we were reacting against sort of the hippie movement at the time, and it was, you know, Richard Hell had a song called Blank Generation, and there was, he always said it was the blank generation because it was fill in the blank and you could be anything that you wanted.
Right.
But there was also this kind of concept that we were sort of, there was an element of kind of like, there's no future. There was a little bit of kind of nihilist dimension to it implied as well, which was very much in reaction to the sort of peace, love, and flowers thing that had come before.
Right.
But in looking at it now, I can kind of see, you know, it's sort of, I mean, the Beats, the hippies, and Joe Strummer from The Clash actually in later years said, well, you know, we really were hippies after all. And you do see this kind of continuity of countercultural dimension to it. And sadly, I think it was, as I said before, kind of the last gasp of all of that, because once the commercialism took over, it just became another part of the kind of the consumerist machine, you know. And so by kind of 1980, it was more or less over.
Right. That's sort of like when the British thing took over.
Yeah. I mean, well, the British, I remember seeing the Damned, who were the first British band to play in New York, and they were just so different from what was happening in New York. But once they came over and once people started playing like the Sex Pistols singles and all of that, things started to change, and there became more of a look that you know that people were expected to have, and all of a sudden it became this movement. But even still, it really didn't, even with the British influence, and I mean I loved a lot of the British bands too.
Sure.
But it wasn't until The Clash became the only band that matters, you know, and they were
right.
these huge rock stars and everything, that at that point I was pretty much done with it. Because it had been, as a movement, it had been sort of co-opted in a way. I mean, you know, the Ramones never made a whole lot of money, and they just kept doing what they did for a long, long time.
Sure.
And that was really true and honest. And I'm not dumping on The Clash here. I think they were a great band, but there was something about the way that it all turned into this marketing thing. And, you know, and you buy your clothes and, you know, dress up, and it just wasn't, it became like a dogma.
Right.
You know, it became, and that's what I saw in the 90s when I went to these shows. It's like, okay, we're punks and this is how we act. Not like, I'm a punk and I'm going to be who I am and express it. And I think that's what the movement really started out being about.
Well, I remember looking at it now, I was a lot more interested in what could be called proto-punk, what we like the 60s garage bands.
That always seemed
when I started really getting into it again, which was sometime in the late 80s when all this stuff, you could start collecting this stuff, I was really struck by a lot of these bands like The Seeds, The 13th Floor Elevators,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Chocolate
yeah.
Watch Band, people like that. And I said, well, how, you know, and it was like, well, there's this whole other thing as well. And that was sort of like, I wouldn't say, I guess you could say it's like the beginnings of it or the pre-beginnings of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're huge influences. I certainly listened to a lot of those bands back then as well. I remember finding this one of the Seeds albums when I was in college, and, you know, it was one of the ones that I played pretty endlessly.
Well, let's talk about some of the other aspects of your youth. We were just, before the broadcast began, since we're talking about punk, tantra, and hopefully one day if I ever do write a book, maybe I'll write a book called Porno Tantra. Because you also mentioned the melody, the harmony, and show world. Let's talk a little bit about that, about your experiences there.
Well, I mean, New York was just, you know, at that time, it was just, everybody talked about it as being this hellacious place, but I mean,
it really was.
Before I go into any of that stuff, it was like, I never got mugged in New York City. I went to the University of Michigan, went away to college, September of 77, I'm there like 2 weeks, in Ann Arbor, I get mugged. New York kind of had this reputation for being so rough, and it was in a way, but there were, it wasn't nearly as bad as it was cracked up to be on that level. And sexually it was just, there were just wild places where, you know, you could see live sex shows, you could, you know, strip clubs that are like nothing that you can find nowadays.
No.
And it was for a teenage kid, you didn't need ID, you know, nobody cared. It was just an enormous amount of fun. And there was a lot of overlap, you know, between those scenes, actually. I mean, a lot of the, and yeah, we were talking earlier about that Carter Stevens film, which I'm looking forward to receiving, which I think is called Punk Rock.
Yes, Punk Rock.
And he actually, I mean, it's a porn film where he actually had several, you know, fairly significant New York bands of the time are in the movie. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
From what I understand, it was supposed to be also, it was either supposed to be a documentary, and then they inserted sex scenes into it, and then later it became a story, or maybe he took parts of this other film and used it in his film, because it's definitely a porn movie. I mean, you got porn actors in it, porn stars of that time period are definitely in it. And I remember it, you know, years ago. I remember 20 years ago. I mean, you go to all, if I went to all my neighborhood stores in Queens, the video stores, it was always there.
Really? Because I never knew about it. I just sort of stumbled on it, and I found a trailer on YouTube, and I'm like, oh my God, the Faster in this porn movie? I had no idea they did that.
Oh yeah, so. it was very well known because of the cover. This was obviously either a re-release or when it was first released on video, as opposed to appearing in the theater. Mm-hmm. The big thing about it, about the cover, was because it said featuring Wade Nichols, star of The Edge of Night.
Uh huh.
Because the male lead in the film was played by Wade Nichols, who at that time had crossed over into soap operas and played a very significant part on the old soap opera The Edge of Night. And then later on it was discovered that he had a past in porn. Remarkably, it did not affect him. He didn't get fired or anything like that. Of course, unfortunately for him, he did contract AIDS and he committed suicide when he found that out.
Oh, really?
That's the story that was told to me, because at that time it was a death sentence, more or less. And
right.
I guess he knew, you know, hey, no point in staying around. I think he was a very good actor. And surprisingly enough, I think a lot of the people who were in porn at that time period, I thought they were all very good performers, and they just simply either didn't get the break or they got the break that was right for them, which was this.
Yeah, well, it was such a different time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, we're talking 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe it's that long ago, but I think the world's a really different place, and there wasn't a porn industry like there is today.
No, it's not at all like it is today.
You know, and this, it was all very New York, and as I said, I mean, there was this kind of crossover between that world and the punk rock world. I mean, I'm pretty sure I saw Sharon Mitchell singing backup. There's a clip of a Dead Boys concert where she was singing backup, and I'm pretty sure I saw her, you know, at CBGB's singing backup with some band or other, probably the Dead Boys. You know, so there was a bit of a crossover between the sexual underground in New York at the time and the punk rock underground, which I wasn't, you know, I mean, I wasn't that acutely aware of it, but certainly there. And it's, I think Legs McNeil wrote a book, he wrote a book called Please Kill Me, which is an oral history of the punk movement, which is a great book. And he's done one on porn as well, which I haven't read. But
I remember that when that book first came out, I remember reading Legs' book, and he yelled, there was also a TV version of it that used to play on Court TV, where they had they made sort of a mini series showing interviews with the people of that time period. Was interesting, especially for me in the late 80s. Show World was the place I used to go to, because you could see all the headliners were all the major stars.
Mm-hmm.
Of that time period. And I remember seeing one week they had listed Susie London,
mm-hmm.
and who was in punk rock, and it's kind of like an unsung heroine. She never quite got the star status of some of the other girls. And I remember going to see her dance and watching her dancing. And as she was dancing towards me, I said, "Punk rock." I said, "Take off, Captain Lust." And she sort of looked at me like, "Oh," and she went away. And then when it was over, I went to one of the guys, "Can I get an autograph?" Because, you know, usually at that time period, you could take a Polaroid with them and get an autograph. And he goes, "She doesn't do that." And I slipped him $5. And I said, "Can I get an autograph?" And he went with the flyer, and she came out, and he pointed to me, and she came over, and she says, "I thought it would be you. You know who I am, don't you?" I said, "Yes, I got all of your movies on videotape." And she was, you know, got afterwards, she relaxed, and she says, "Well, you know, I was involved with some people who were really trying to make, we were trying to make real movies.
Mm-hmm.
We films like Take Off, you know, we had a script, we tried to really do it." And I said, "Yeah, I know. I thought Take Off was a very good film." I said, "But what happened?" She says, "Coke and the VCR."
Mm-hmm.
Everybody got coked out, and the VCR destroyed theatrical movie making.
Yeah.
And after that, you know, it just became this, you know, once you start shooting on videotape, you know, the storyline, the structures, whatever, that went totally out the window.
Well, and I think that AIDS had a big, you know,
oh, yes.
a huge impact as well. I mean,
yes.
You know, this New York in the 70s that we're talking about was before AIDS. And,
right.
I mean, even though I was, you know, straight and, you know, it didn't, I mean, even in the early days of the epidemic as a straight person, it was sort of like, once you got over the kind of the fear of the very earliest years of just, you know, it could be transmitted anyway, but then it became this gay disease. But you didn't have any consciousness of any kind of risk being attached to sex, really.
Right.
And I think that once AIDS sort of loomed, it became culturally like that whole freedom that existed in the 70s became something that people were just afraid of.
Yeah, it completely flipped, and it, especially with the rise of Reagan and that whole thing, it completely flipped, and it just simply, or it went like underground again, and you had to be a little bit more, a little more careful. But sort of like the old idea started coming back. Well, you see, this is what happens when you do this. You can't go against nature.
Yeah, and that the kind of the sex, the connection between sex and punishment.
Yes.
I think that was a big thing that kind of reemerged when the AIDS epidemic started to hit. And I mean, in a lot of ways, understandably so, because at that point people didn't really know how to prevent it or how to be safe.
Right.
But the cultural climate changed, kind of 180 degrees at that point. And I was living in New York in the early 80s, and by, kind of 83, all of that sort of openness began to go away.
Yeah. Unfortunately, another opportunity I missed.
But, so there are a lot of things that kind of fed into this kind of reemergence of a sex-negative culture. And I think we're at a place now where things are getting better. I mean, Giuliani's gone from New York for one
thing. Yes, yes.
Please
don't come back. Don't run for governor. Please don't come back.
And we do have kind of the... There is a reemergence of a more kind of sex positive culture that in many ways is more inclusive than it was back then.
Right.
We're Patricia and I co-sponsor this event called the Pleasure Salon, which is it's a social gathering in New York for people from all different alternative sexual communities, from the Tantra world to BDSM to sex magic people to GLBT, the whole spectrum, and we really want to encourage just an openness and a kind of social networking among these different communities.
Yes.
And I don't think, as great as the punk scene was and as open as it was to a wide range of people and sexualities, it was a lot of that was kind of under the table, and you did still have kind of the macho rock band mentality that was around there quite a lot. And I think now things are just, in some ways, there isn't quite the level of freedom, and unfortunately, in my mind, there's not quite the level of sleaziness that New York used to have, and New York is so expensive that it can't support the kind of culture that existed then.
No, I was just looking at, and I'll send it to you later. There's a really cool website. It's called Vanishing New York, and he's a blogger. He's also on Facebook. And I saw an article that he posted there called Sex in the City, the cast of Sex in the City says, "Don't blame us." That basically how so much of it has changed and become so glorified, commercialism and consumerism, due to the success of Sex in the City and people wanting to replicate that lifestyle. Even though, folks, it's a TV show, it's a movie.
And it's really, I haven't watched it much, but the episodes I've seen, it's really like, it's not sex, it's materialism in the city.
Right. Well, I'm a fan. I have all the episodes on DVD, and I'm also an admirer. I admire the works of Candace Bushnell, who is, of course, the writer who was the original Carrie, who wrote that. And actually, her writings are a lot different than what the show portrays. It's a little more darker.
Yeah, I remember reading her some back, 20 years ago or so.
Yeah,
I guess.
It's not as, I think a lot of the success of that series is due to the personality of Sarah Jessica Parker, and of course, you know, the fabulous shoes and all the and all that, the culture and everything with it. You know, it certainly has changed a lot, and just now that, you know, even if you wanted to do that kind of life, you're not doing it in Manhattan, certainly. No one can afford it. You have to go to Williamsburg, and now no one can afford that. So you got to go to Bushwick, and pretty soon no one's going to be able to afford that. And go down to Greenpoint, and I think you can still afford that, but not for much longer.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, the other thing is that it all, to me, seems, not that I'm really that tapped in, a lot of that kind of bohemian thing now, unlike 30 years ago, it just seems kind of imitative.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, there's nothing that I find that's, you know, hugely original about it. It's all very, it's retro.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not, to, I mean, God, I mean, the Ramones, you know, borrowed from girl group, and you know, the New York Dolls were hugely influenced by girl group and R&B and blues and all of that. It's not to say there shouldn't be any influences, but there, I really feel like that period in the 70s was kind of like the last time that anybody was going, let's do something new and radical. And I mean, I think hip-hop culture at that time as well was the same way, you know, which was just starting in New York. That wasn't really part of my world, but it was, there was this incredible ferment at
right.
that time.
And yeah, that's something that was original. It wasn't just imitative. It was something that they really created right then and there.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what it takes is to, you know, be in a situation where you can do something like that. And you know, but then, you know, that's the question. How can you do that now?
I don't know that you can. I mean, I think the thing that I find incredibly promising about what's going on now is that there is, as I was saying, a much more kind of inclusive possibility for people.
Right.
That didn't really exist then. I mean, we've taught to high school kids and just seeing their level of acceptance of different forms of sexual expression compared to what it was back then is extraordinary. So that's a real plus. But to bring it back to Tantra, I think that the other piece of for me that was related to Tantra about that whole early punk movement was this kind of potential for ecstatic experience that existed, an unexpected ecstatic experience. I mean, virtually every band that I saw at CBGB's for the first time, I would think to myself, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Mm.
And I'm a little, maybe even a little afraid of it.
Right.
But there's really something here. I mean, the first experience was it was the end of the Vietnam War concert, spring of 1975 in Central Park, big free concert. And most of the performers were, you know, there were sort of famous folk musicians. I think Pete Seeger played. I know that Tom Paxton and Phil Oakes played. I think it was Phil Oakes' last performance, as a matter of fact.
Right.
But Patti Smith performed there. And that was my introduction to the whole thing. And I mean, it was unforgettable, and it was disturbing. It was completely weird for that setting. I remember her talking about violence and rock and roll, and, you know, this was an end of the war concert. But I was like, this is really interesting. I don't know if I like it, but it's really interesting. And, you know, and then I went to see her about 6 months later at the Bottom Line shows, the first show she did in New York after Horses came out. And I was 16, I think. Yeah, 16. The Bottom Line did generally card people, so I went with the sister of a friend who was old enough, and she got me in. And I remember we sat through the show, and we were unable to walk when we left. It was just such an intense experience. And, you know, I mean, there are so many bands that I saw that were like that. And the combination of that, like, they're a little scary. They're doing something that is totally unexpected, and they're transporting. They're taking me out of myself.
Right.
There's this kind of mystical dimension to the whole experience, which I consider to be very tantric.
Yes.
Because it's really, you know, I saw you posted about losing your ego.
Yes.
On Facebook, and it's like, yeah, I don't want to lose my ego.
Yeah.
You know, but losing your ego for a while is a great thing.
Right.
And these experiences, these performers, the intensity of it, and the community of the people, could, you know, it could just take you into this really kind of mystical state. And for me, I think it was really a foundation for where I've gotten to now.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think it would be cool to get your perspective and get a little bit of clarity. Because what I had posted, I say it's not a question so much of losing your ego as it is transcending conditioning and programming.
Yeah.
And isn't that what we're really seeking? I mean, we're not really seeking to lose our identity or our personality, and I think that's where most people make, I think, a terrible mistake. I think it's about transcending your limitations, your programming, your conditioning, whatever you want to call it. It's what Dr. John Lilly called metaprogramming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's what Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson talked about. It's not about losing your identity. It's about getting rid of the things that hold you back.
Yeah. And they can hold you back in a myriad of different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think to label that ego, I think, is a great misnomer.
Yeah. I mean, John Mumford says, in order to function in the world, we need our ego.
Right.
You know, and I think he's right about that. We do. If you lose your ego, you won't be able to feed yourself.
Right.
And I think that when they talk about the loss of ego, excuse me, I'm going to need some water. Can you hang
Absolutely.
On a second?
Absolutely, sure. Yeah, I think it's a very important distinction to make, and I think it's I just think it sets people off in a wrong direction to say you have to lose your ego, and without even really truly defining what that means. And really, I think when I look at the writings of John Lilly, and particularly Robert Anton Wilson, I get a much more clear idea. Well, it's the thought forms, it's the programming, it's the conditioning, it's the social conditioning.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
what
you want to transcend.
I think that what, you know, when people say you need to lose your ego, you should run away.
Yeah.
Because that usually means you should surrender to me and become my disciple and just follow.
Right.
And it's very easy to say if somebody's messing with you and you resist because you don't want to be messed with. And I'll make this very concrete in a moment. It's very easy for them to say, well, it's your ego that's blocking you from having this better experience.
Right.
I did an intensive, I won't name the organization, but one of these kinds of intensive programs, and I came out of it and I felt really that I had been badly manipulated and brainwashed.
Right.
And where it really became evident to me that that's what was going on was when they did this whole process, and then they played this John Denver song, and I'm crying. And everybody in the room is crying, and all of a sudden I'm like, I hate John Denver. I'm not, you know, this isn't me. I'm being manipulated into this. And at that moment, it was like, this is all BS, you know. I mean, it just was clear to me that it was not, that I was being manipulated for somebody else's advantage.
Right.
And when I came out of it and I sort of said, I feel like I've been drugged and I don't want to do this anymore. And their response was, you need to take another workshop.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't think the word ego came up, but that's the kind of process where somebody could easily say, well, it's just your ego getting in the way.
Right.
No, your ego is in that kind of situation is actually what protects you from other people messing with you. I think there's a place for losing your ego, and certainly in Tantra, you know, in certainly high states of sex and other kinds of intense experiences, your ego does melt. You do merge, and that's great. But you have to go back and live in the real world.
Right.
And without an ego, you have nothing to enable you to function in that environment. So it is, you know, and the tantric approach is really about, you know, breaking down your conditioning, arriving at some truer sense of who you are.
Yes.
You know, not the ego that's been constructed by you should act this way, this is, you know, what's socially accepted, this is the way we do things here. It's really about stripping that aspect away.
Right.
And I do think that the loss of ego, that intense merger experience, is a component of coming to that kind of awareness. But it shouldn't be I don't think it should be the objective. It's a tool. Just like non-ejaculatory sex is a tool.
Yes.
You know, it's all about becoming skillful with these different things. And I mean, that kind of takes me back to the way that punk and tantra connect. I mean, I think that when I was in my teens and I was and deeply into the punk thing, I didn't have the sophistication or the awareness to see how those experiences were a tool for something bigger. They were just experiences that I was seeking for their own sake. And because it was a community and environment where I, as a sort of misfit kid, could feel a sense of belonging and maybe even importance. But looking back on it, I feel like those moments were kind of signals,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, or landmarks that I could use to navigate, could look back on and navigate in the future, use to navigate in the future. They told me what was possible. And that's where I kind of see the whole punk thing as being very influential. And I think the stance of punk is also really important too, you know, because as I said before, I just, this kind of new age lovey-dovey, everything's nice tantra, you know, I mean, in the classical tradition, people go and meditate in cremation grounds. You know,
yes.
It was about the full spectrum. It was about the things that society at least considers the darkest, and also achieving these extraordinary ecstatic experiences, or doing both at the same time. And you know, and I mean, I feel like that's very much part of what punk in its original form was all about. It was about finding the ecstatic in, you know, in the scummiest bar in town.
Right.
And so, I mean, I do see a kind of, you know, full circle there.
Well, you were also, you were part of something called Chemistry Volume 4.
Oh, yeah.
that Tristan Taramino directed, which is kind of gonzo porn, reality porn. Not that you actually had sex, you didn't, but you and Patricia, I think, did a wonderful demonstration of Tantra that you blew these porn people away.
Yeah, that was a very interesting and just an incredible experience. And I think that the decision to participate in that film was kind of, for me, connected with all of what we've been talking about.
Right.
It's about taking this stuff into context that people don't really think it belongs in. And to Tristan's eternal credit, she totally understands that.
Right.
And it's about messing with, you know, it's about messing with both the genre that Tantra has become in America, which is this very new agey thing, and the porn genre.
Right.
And she totally got that, and it was, I think it was brilliant that, I mean, the whole thing started more or less as a kind of a lark. We were out there making a couple of instructional films that are explicit. But we wanted to see her set, and she invited us. And she said, "Well, you guys sign model releases." And we figured it's reality porn, so we might be in an incidental shot or something, and sure. So we get there, and she says, "Well, will you teach the cast a class?" So, okay, so we did. And it just, I mean, I think that if people watch it, they'll be in for some real surprises. And although not everyone in the cast was totally taking it seriously, I think we reached people in a very interesting way, and we certainly learned a lot as well.
Oh yeah, you definitely got Penny Flame.
Yeah,
I mean, she broke down afterwards.
Well, I didn't want to spoil that for people.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's, I don't know if you can actually claim that's what drove her into rehab and working with Dr. Drew now.
I don't know.
But she certainly was very affected by it, as opposed to the male lead who just basically left the room.
Tyler Knight really was very, very interested and took it very seriously.
Right. That meant the blonde guy.
Yeah.
He left the room. He didn't even stay in the room. I think that it was, it's a really a remarkable video. And, I know Anton, who's the founder of Sexy Spirits, he always says that he thinks that people who are swingers are who do this are like one step from enlightenment, because they are challenging all these belief systems and programming and stuff like that. And certainly the people who I have encountered, Candida Royale, I think are very, I would
well,
say
Candida,
very enlightened people,
Candida,
very authentic
incredible,
people
yeah.
who have done a lot of work, particularly Candida. You know, I if I had to go and line up with someone, I'd line up with them.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to go pay my money to someone, I'd pay my money to them, you know, before I go, you know, go through that
another another New Age nonsense again, or any other kind of thing. I have had my most positive experiences have been in this community of people who I've met in the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize because I do think that in the adult industry and in the swinging world, there's a lot of really unconscious behavior that goes on.
Oh, yes.
But I think that there are people, you know, Candida being one, but there are quite a few other people who are doing this kind of work in a way that I think is closer to what the spirit of Tantra is about.
Yes.
And we say this in our second book. We talk about this event, Dark Odyssey, that Tristan produces, and we've been teaching there for a number of years. And, you know, in these alternative sexual communities, I think that there's something that's much closer to the authentic spirit of Tantra than in a lot of the New Age workshops, because it's people who are consciously pushing the boundaries and taking this attitude of, let's go there and see what happens. Let's experiment. Let's explore and discover what's going on. It's not sort of locked into this whole kind of structure of, dancing in the light, as we always kind of joke about. And it's also not mired in this kind of pop psych, you know, encounter group stuff.
Right. That's the other side of it too, as well.
So it's when this alternative and sometimes very extreme sexual exploration is done with awareness and intention and sort of seriousness of purpose. That's not to say there's no pleasure involved, but where people are doing it not just to check out, that's where I think there's this just incredible possibilities, and that's what I find really exciting and inspiring. And so, you know, teaching that class in chemistry in some ways was, you know, the questions that we got asked are things that, you know, that regular people don't ask, you
right.
know, and that was a lot of fun, and to see someone who's been making porn for years, you know, suddenly get some new insight, that's like really cool.
Yeah. And you're going to be teaching, I believe. There's going to be a weekend coming up called Enlightened Sex in the City.
That's right, on Saturday at Atmananda Yoga, and I'm afraid I don't have the address off the top of my head, but I think it's on 23rd Street.
Let me see. I can probably call that up right now. Let's see and get that. And also Anton will be there as well, and hopefully I'll be able to get it.
Yeah, we're in the first slot, and we're doing a kind of combined thing with sort of introduction to tantric concepts and relationship as spiritual practice.
324 Lafayette Street, the 7th floor.
Lafayette Street, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It's down,
I was
downtown.
it's
almost
okay,
in
so
punk
it's,
rock place.
Yeah. Pretty close to the old CBGBs, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing...
It's not very recognizable now, though.
No. Not at all. So we'll be doing introduction, just kind of a general overview of sort of key principles in Tantra, and then we'll be talking about relationship as spiritual practice.
Oh, great.
Which, you know, which is kind of... very much the core of what we're about is treating each other with reverence as
yes.
completely as we can, and that's kind of the core of our practice. And again, I mean, I think that, you know, we don't live in ancient India, and so a lot of what this is about is how do the philosophical principles of Tantra apply in the modern world. and in a culture and an environment that's very different from where Tantra originated.
Yes.
And, you know, and in a way, I think a lot of what we've been talking about with the punk and all of that is again, you know, how do the principles of Tantra apply in modern life? And how do we find the tantric elements in these experiences that may on the surface seem like they have nothing to do with it?
Well, it strikes me, like when you said about the first time when you were at that concert and you felt a little unsure, you felt maybe perhaps a little overwhelmed. I don't want to say if that's the way it should be, but it certainly is, you know, it certainly is a pretty good indication, though.
Yeah.
And
that that overwhelmed feeling can come in a lot of different ways. I mean, yeah. You know, to talk specifically about that, I've pretty vivid memories of a few bands that I, the first time that I saw them, you know, the Patti Smith thing I just mentioned. I remember the first show I went to at CBGB's was about a month after that Patti Smith Bottom Line show, and I saw Talking Heads and Television. And I remember thinking that the Talking Heads were just about the weirdest thing that I'd ever seen. And I really didn't know what to make of them. Television was a little more accessible. I'd heard some of their music already, and they weren't quite as bizarre seeming, but I just couldn't kind of wrap my brain around the Talking Heads. Then the Ramones, I'd heard a lot about them, but I didn't know their music, and this was maybe a couple months after that, so early 76, before their first album came out. And they were the loudest thing I had ever heard.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the fastest thing I had ever heard. And the set lasted maybe 30 minutes. And you just kind of went, what was that?
Right.
The other band that immediately comes to mind was the Cramps, who I'd known their guitar player who worked in a Brian Gregory, their guitar player, worked in a record store in, near a friend of mine's house, and I'd go in there and buy stuff, and he'd always say, you know, oh, you got to come see my band, and I finally did go to see them, and I was like, this looks like Elvis meets Frankenstein. And I don't know what the hell to make of this. And they're weird and scary. And, you know, it took me a while to grow to love them. But it just was so out there and so different from, you know, certainly from anything you'd hear on the radio.
Right.
And the whole... the whole demeanor of these bands, the whole, you know, it was, and they were all, you know, they were, each of those bands really different from the other, but they all had this just unique sensibility and an element of something that was threatening to what you were brought up to think was, or not even what you were brought up, but what the culture was bombarding you with in terms of what a, you know, what a rock band should sound like or look like or act like. Not that they were totally different, totally unlike anything else, but they were different enough that you just got very disoriented.
Right.
And it's in those moments of disorientation sometimes that, like, the really extraordinary things can happen. And, you know,
which I think is a pretty important thing to say, because I think a lot of people are not prepared for that, and they're not, and they're expecting everything to be all so wonderful and light, and you know, it's not going to come like that probably, unless you're someone who's cleared out already. If you're cleared out, then you all need the experience to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that if you're expecting, you know, if you're living in that narrow range and you're not, I'm not quite sure how to say this, but I think that there's a way in which people, if they're keeping it in that light realm, they're actually not allowing for the possibility.
Right.
They're being very conservative in a way that's limiting. And they may think that they're doing stuff that's pushing the envelope in some way, or they may think that they're being spiritual, but spirituality is not about being comfortable necessarily.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
On the other hand, it's not about being artificially uncomfortable. It's going back to what I was saying before. If you feel like somebody's messing with you and making you uncomfortable and it doesn't feel right, chances are that's true. Chances are that they're pushing some agenda of their own that's not working for you.
Right.
And I think discernment is a very important part of the tantric tradition. In Tibetan Buddhism, they say you should, spend years and years with someone before you decide to accept them as your teacher.
I think if you're gasping for air in a sweat lodge, I think you should get the fuck out of there. And I'm on,
yeah, really.
We're on adult radio here, so I can say that word.
And if somebody says, oh, well, it's you're dying and you're letting go of all your past crap or something. No, you're freaking dying,
I mean, I don't want to make fun of the people who went through that experience. But at the same time, for people who are out there who haven't, this is a lesson to wise up.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that's kind of the most egregious example of the kind of stuff that goes on. But it goes on all the time in this kind of spiritual New Age world. And there are people out there who will gladly take your money, who will gladly manipulate you and take more of your money. And people just are too credulous.
Yeah. I think there are people who will take your money. They will willingly take your money. And I think there are people out there who think they're doing something good, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably the most blind at all, with their own discoveries and their own dogmas and their own things. But I think the whole thing is always to have discernment and never to lose that.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had experiences where I've paid, even working with people where I've known, like, there's something not right here, but I want to continue because I'm gonna learn something that's important. And even with that, and having made the conscious choice, knowing the limitations and the risks involved, and this is when I've been, I was fairly advanced in my study and stuff before. Working with John Mumford, but you sometimes even with that level of awareness of the perils that you may be exposed to, you can sort of get bitten in the ass by it.
Yeah.
And it's and again, this is where I think ego comes in. You need to have an ego, because without that, you're just going to be victimized.
Yeah.
And if you make the kind of choice that I'm talking about, and you know that you're doing something that may come back and have some bad ramifications for you, it really is the ego that's going to help you deal with that after it happens.
So friends, make friends with your ego. I would say the poor ego needs a little respect, and our egos need love too.
Yeah. and the I think the key really is that instead of being run by your ego, you know, use your ego. And again, Swamiji, Dr. Mumford, translates Tantra as tool for expansion. And from the tantric perspective, everything is a tool.
Right.
So it's really all about how you use those tools. It's not that you want to suppress or deny anything. It's like, this is part of what makes me up. Now what can I do with it?
Right.
So that, in a sense, instead of letting your ego run you, then run your ego and choose when you use it. I think, and that goes back to like the deconditioning thing that you were talking about.
Right. Well, you know, I think this has been a really great evening, a really great conversation. I'm glad that we had a chance to sit here and talk about this, and I look forward to seeing more of your classes, and definitely invite you to book another workshop at Sexy Spirits.
Great, thank you.
Have another, maybe even come back with Patricia and do another broadcast here. I want to thank Mark Michaels of Tantra PM, and also the co-author of Essence of Tantric Sexuality and Tantra for Erotic Empowerment, which also you have a wonderful, you have produced some wonderful DVDs as well.
Yeah, Tantric Sexual Massage for Lovers and Advanced Tantric Sex Secrets. Not really that advanced. I think anybody could really benefit from viewing it. And they deal with material that's in Essence, but they're you know, if you're more visual, they really give you step by step.
And you also do online classes as well.
Yeah, basically we guide people through Tantra for Erotic Empowerment, which you can either just read or use as a workbook, and we do a guided feedback kind of program with that.
Well, once again, thank you to Mark, and thank you for all the people who are listening tonight. This is Stephen Otero speaking, and you've been listening to Mondo Eros Live on BBSRadio.com. Thank you, and good evening.